Here it is.
From deep inside your radio.
And cold. Ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. You know, I believe, if you've been paying attention, that Monsignor Lynn in Philadelphia was found guilty of one count. I think acquitted on two, but the one was, you know, ignoring the abusers. But this, ladies and gentlemen, you may not know. Apropos of our story last week, something I repeated to you last week on this broadcast about the Vatican or American bishops saying, we need a new PR guy. Well, the Vatican was listening. The Vatican has brought in the Fox News correspondent in Rome to help improve its communication strategy as it tries to cope with one of its most serious scandals in decades, according to the AP. Now, by the way, this most serious scandal is not what you think. No, it's not about priests abusing kids. It's about leaked documents from the Vatican. Greg Burke will become senior communications advisor in the Vatican's Secretariat of State. Yes, it's news of the godly, but they got one of those. Burke's job, according to the current Vatican spokesman, will be to help integrate the handling of communications matters within the Vatican's top administrative office and handle its relations with the Holy See press office and other Vatican communications offices. Sounds like a church, doesn't it? Burke just happens to be a member of Opus Dei, conservative Catholic movement. Nutty how he'd get assigned to cover Rome for Fox News, isn't it? The Vatican has been bedeviled by this scandal over leaked documents, having to do partly with the Vatican Bank. News of the godly. I know. Ladies and gentlemen, you speaking of which, you may have heard that there was a course being taught, at least one, to the American Military Officer Corps, in which they were called upon to regard themselves as engaging in a war with Islam. Well, we now know why that happened. This wasn't the work of just one misguided teacher. According to an inquiry ordered by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it was the result of, quote, institutional failures in oversight and judgment, unquote, at one of the military's top educational institutions. This was a months-long military-wide review following a series of articles in Wired magazine's Danger Room section. The worst of the courses was taught at Joint Forces Staff College in Norfolk, Virginia, titled Perspectives on Islam and Islamic Radicalism. The course became modified from sort of an inoffensive examination of the roots of extremism to adopt a teaching methodology that portrayed Islam almost entirely in a negative way, says Colonel Dave Lappin, a spokesman for General Martin Dempsey, head of the Joint Chiefs. The instructor of the course, Army Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Dooley, spent weeks arguing in the course that the U.S. was at war with the Islamic faith. In planning for the war's next phases, Dooley invited his students to, quote, use the lessons of Hiroshima to wipe out whole cities at once and, quote, to target the civilian population wherever necessary. We're the good guys. Dooley has now been stripped of his teaching position at the college and formally reprimanded, but he's still in the Army. Yeah, he's in. Talk about an army of one. Hello, welcome to the show.
Stay.
middle of the desert. We are in the middle of the desert.
No, Spike and Rachel, we're not. We're almost at the ocean, but from the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Well, you tell me whether it's good news or bad news. I think it's a little of both. Both. Carbon dioxide emissions have risen by even more than previously thought, according to new data analyzed by the British newspaper The Guardian, casting doubt on whether the world can avoid dangerous climate change. The data emerged as governments met in Rio at that conference. Global carbon emissions from energy are up 48% compared to 1992 when the original Earth Summit took place in Rio. You remember that? That did such good work. In 2010, the latest year for which figures have been compiled, the Energy Information Administration here in the U.S., said the world emitted 31.8 billion tons of carbon from energy consumption, a climb of 6.7% over the year before, significantly higher than the previous best estimate made by the International Energy Agency last year. Increases in fossil fuel use of this magnitude are likely to carry the world far beyond the temperature rise of 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit by 2050 that scientists have estimated is the limit of safety beyond which climate change is likely to become nasty and irreversible. According to the new EIA data, not to be confused with the IAEA, carbon dioxide emissions from the United States have resumed their rise after a brief blip caused by, you know, the financial crap. That increase came despite the much-vaunted switch from coal to shale gas, with its lower emissions than coal. China, which in 2006 took over the U.S.'s historical lead as world's biggest emitter, raced to get ahead in 2010, up 15% over the previous year, and a 240% increase since 1992. China alone is responsible now for about one quarter of global carbon emissions from energy, emitting about 48% more than the U.S. This backs up recent evidence. China may be emitting more carbon dioxide than had previously been thought. But, you know, if they got to fill those toys with lead somehow. The ancient reserves of methane gas seeping from the melting Arctic ice cap told researchers what they already knew. As the permafrost thaws, there is a release of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas that causes climate warming. The trick was figuring out how much, said Jeff Clanton, professor of oceanography at Florida State. His team, whose findings were published in Nature Geoscience, documented a large number of gas seep sites in the Arctic where permafrost is thawing and glaciers receding. Until recently, the frozen soil and ice served to plug up or block these vents, these seep sites, but thawing conditions have allowed the conduits to open and deep geologic methane now escapes. But a team of scientists have drilled holes through an Antarctic ice shelf, the Fimbul ice shelf, Fimbul with an F, to gather the first direct measurements regarding melting of the shelf's underside. A group of elephant seals. Now you got to feel sorry for them. Are they elephants or are they seals? Do they remember or just blubber? Outfitted with sensors that measure salinity, temperature, and depth, added fundamental information to the scientists' data set, which led the researcher to conclude that parts of eastern Antarctica are melting at significantly lower rates than predicted by current models. And they're too thin anyway. It has been unclear until now how much warm deep water rises below the ice shelf. Previous ocean models have predicted temperatures and melt rates that are too high, suggesting a significant mass loss in this region that is actually not taking place as fast as previously thought, said the lead author of the study from the Norwegian Polar Institute. So, maybe not as fast warming, at least in that part of the Antarctic. But, and here we go again. At nearly 4 feet tall, the emperor penguin is Antarctica's largest seabird. If global temperatures continue to rise, however, the emperor penguin in Terre Adélie in East Antarctica may eventually disappear, according to a new study led by researchers from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution published in Global Change Biology. Over the last century, we've already observed the disappearance of the Dion Islet's penguin colony close to the West Antarctic Peninsula, says lead author of the new study. The decline in those penguins, says the author, may be connected to a simultaneous decline in Antarctic sea ice due to warming temperatures in the region. Unlike other seabirds, emperors breed and raise their young almost exclusively on sea ice. They also fool around, as we learned a couple weeks ago. If that ice breaks up and disappears early in the breeding season, massive breeding failure may occur. First analyses of the longest sediment core ever collected on land in the Arctic, published this week in Science, provide dramatic, quote, astonishing, unquote, documentation that intense warm intervals, warmer than scientists thought possible, occurred there over the past 2.8 million years. We're not the first, maybe. These extreme interglacial warm periods correspond closely with times when parts of Antarctica were ice-free and also warm, suggesting strong inter-hemispheric climate connectivity, say the project's three co-chief scientists. The polar regions are much more vulnerable to change than once believed, they add. And the U.S. lead scientist says, what we see is astonishing. We had no idea we'd find this. It's astonishing to see so many intervals when the Arctic was really warm, enough so forests were growing where today we see tundra and permafrost, and the intensity of warming is completely unexpected. The other astounding thing is we were able to determine that during many times when the West Antarctic ice sheet disappeared, we see a corresponding warm period following very quickly in the Arctic. So, what was happening then? Carbon capture and storage won't work, according to a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, because underground earthquakes are certain to cause the carbon to be released too soon. That's the gloomy prediction of a group of Stanford University scientists, and a blow to those who seek an engineered response to climate change. And that methane, one more time, the ancient reserves of methane gas seeping from the melting Arctic ice cap, well, that's the same story. I printed it twice, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure. News of the Warm, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. I guess you know that we're free again here in American Broadcasting. It's not the American Broadcasting Company. I mean broadcasting here in America. We're free to swear, according to the U.S. Supreme Court. Overturned those fines, those big A black fines for broadcasters totaling a $1.24 million. That's big. You know, for people saying the F word on award shows because they were so thrilled. So just don't have the kids listen to the rest of the show, ladies and gentlemen. It's gonna get rough in here. Maybe sooner than any of us wants. Oh, that's because that's the wrong music. That you see. If it weren't for the FCC, I'd have sworn right there. But now, so now I don't know what to do. Oh, I know. I'll read the trades for you. From two different trades, more about car talk. Oh, that's me laughing at me. I shouldn't be doing that. I'll read these for you. How about that? From Radiosurvivor.com, back in the 1990s, Wisconsin Public Radio had its own automotive program called About Cars, airing on Saturday morning. Then, in 1996, the network decided it was time to move About Cars to a different time slot, replacing it with Car Talk. The new time slot was unacceptable to About Cars host Matt Joseph, so Wisconsin Public Radio canceled that program altogether. They received about 1,500 calls and letters of protest. The Wisconsin legislature even commissioned an investigation and held a hearing on the issue. Listeners and legislators couldn't figure out why Wisconsin Public Radio would cancel the network's second highest rated Saturday program, a strong pledge drive fundraiser. As it turns out, the motivation was simple. It received a grant allowing it to get Car Talk for free in exchange for NPR continuing to distribute its own syndicated program, What Do You Know? Wisconsin Public Radio could replace a program it had to finance to produce, even if popular, with a popular national program it received on the special deal for free. Car Talk ended up being one of the most widely distributed non-news programs in public radio. And from Current, the trade publication of public radio, as previously reported, the Car Talk program start airing in October will be recycling calls from previous shows. Car Talk's producers have systematically archived all the calls and rated each one on an entertainment scale of 1 to 5. Doug Berman, producer of Car Talk, sent a letter to stations assuring them that a less than fresh Car Talk will still attract strong audiences. "We're editing the series to make it better, stronger, and funnier," he wrote. NPR has already been testing the approach by distributing more archived shows in recent years. According to Arbitron People Meter data from 16 important markets measured across 28 weeks from 2009 to 2010, encore hours did not consistently draw fewer listeners than new episodes did. NPR surveyed listeners about their awareness of hearing old Car Talk calls. 70% disagreed with the statement, quote, "It seems that Car Talk is repeating old shows," unquote. We've been overestimating the intelligence of NPR listeners, apparently. Berman said listener loyalty to the show increased over the past year, even as archived shows increased. The encore shows will be presented just as today's shows are, according to NPR. "The fact that the guys are no longer recording new shows will be public, but we don't feel it's in the interest of the series to continually advertise that at the beginning of each new show," by which they mean old show. By calling it a new show in the statement, NPR is showing you how that works. The hosts will continue to give out the 800 number listeners call for advice. Callers will hear a message stating the program is no longer accepting calls. Please call. Please give. Your gift is no longer accepted. The archived episodes may include dated references, such as mentions of older car models. NPR says producers, though, will remove non-essential references, such as mileage numbers that seem excessively low, or advice that a caller go immediately to his nearest Yugo dealer. They will put back references to Fiat dealers. It's new, it's old, it's public, it's private. It's a wonderful world we live in, ladies and gentlemen. That's the kind of sunny outlook I get when I read the trades for you, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news of the atom. News of the Atom with our friend Addy the Atom.
Hey, just got off the plane.
Why don't you just ride the jet stream or something? You're so almost weightless.
Oh, I got weight.
All right. Deadline Toledo. Federal regulators say they agree with an Ohio utility company's assessment that cracks found in the concrete shell of a nuclear plant along Lake Erie can be traced to a blizzard nearly 35 years ago. The NRC says it accepts the findings from First Energy Corporation that a lack of exterior weatherproofing at the plant caused the concrete to crack. Who would think of weatherproofing a concrete in a nuclear plant in Ohio?
It's an easy mistake to make.
I guess so. Obviously. Regulators said this week they also approve of First Energy's plan for the shell's continuing safety that involves applying a new coating and performing additional tests at the Davis-Bessey plant near Toledo, which reopened last December. So congratulations to them. No cracks. See what I did?
Yeah, you're laughing at your own stuff.
Somebody's got to do it for new material. Tokyo Electric Power has defended its actions following the earthquake and tsunami, claiming that interference by the Japanese Prime Minister's office confused workers at the Fuk No. 1 plant during the initial crisis period. This is according to TEPCO's own final report. Released this week, it was compiled by an in-house panel. You want me to say it, or are you going to say it?
Better than an outhouse panel.
That's right. Convened in June last year, the report was based on about 600 hearings with employees and others, as well as computer analysis on why meltdowns occurred in the plant's reactors. The report, however, left many issues unclear, such as why the number 2 reactor released massive amounts of radiation into the air. It also made no references to the responsibilities of TEPCO's chairman and other executives. The report emphasized that intervention by then-Prime Minister Khan and other top government officials in the Prime Minister's office caused unnecessary confusion by making unrealistic demands. Khan phoned Masao Yoshida, then head of the plant, proposing that the plant's reactors could be cooled down by referring to the Three Mile Island incident. It described the instructions as, quote, unrealistic given the actual state of the reactors. The flow of water and steam was too high in the troubled San Onofre nuclear plant steam generators. That's the main cause of excessive vibration that resulted in the heavy tube wear, resulting in the months-long shutdown of both reactors. That's the conclusion delivered this week by members of a special investigations team from the NRC. The team also said the manufacturer of the plant's steam generator, Mitsubishi, used a flawed computer simulation during the manufacturing process to estimate the flow of water and steam.
Tough to figure out water and steam, isn't it?
Yeah. Haven't been around long enough with that, with water and steam, I guess. They're new. A few members of the audience jeered at the NRC team members. This computer simulation used by Mitsubishi had underpredicted the velocities of steam and water inside steam generators by factors of 3 to 4 times, said an NRC investigator. It's a major multiple, my friend.
I'm not your friend.
Dateline Tokyo, Japanese authorities failed to disclose U.S. data about the spread of radiation spewing from the crippled nuclear plant last year, said a cabinet minister this week, leaving some evacuees fleeing in the same direction as the wind was carrying the radioactive emissions. News that Japan's nuclear watchdog and the Science and Technology Ministry sat on information collected by U.S. military aircraft is likely to add to mistrust of nuclear power just days after the Japanese government approved the restart of 2 idled reactors. U.S. military aircraft had gathered radiation data from March 17 to 19 over a 28-mile radius, found that people in an area about 15 miles northwest of the plant, where some people were moving, were exposed to the annual permissible level of radiation within 8 hours. That information was passed to the Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency and the Science and Technology Ministry. Neither passed it on to the Prime Minister's office, which was overseeing the evacuations. Says the industry minister now, it is extremely regrettable that this information was not shared or utilized properly within the government. And I have no words to apologize, especially to disaster victims.
You could try, I'm sorry.
I don't think that really. So thousands of people fled in the same direction as the radioactive material was drifting. You see, ladies and gentlemen. Clean, safe, strafe, to people make our friend the atom. You can take a swim today, Addie?
No. I don't want to get sand in my proton.
All right, then. You just chill. From the home of traffic jams, this is Le Show, and now, news from outside the bubble. The British Financial Services Authority is revealing it has found evidence of serious mis-selling at some of Britain's largest banks as part of a review of the way lenders pushed small businesses to buy controversial interest rate swaps. According to the Telegraph, this is interesting to Americans mainly because the same thing happened to state and local governments in this country. They were sold exotic financial instruments they didn't really understand, and here's how it worked. Well, we'll get to that. Banks are braced in Britain for a formal regulatory investigation. That's how you know it's not the United States. Into how thousands of small and medium-sized businesses came to be sold billions of dollars worth of complex interest rate derivatives. A full investigation would take at least a year. The results of the initial review are going to be announced this week, prompted by evidence encountered by uncovered by an investigation by the Telegraph newspaper, which uncovered cases where small businesses such as chip shops, electrical stores, and bed and breakfasts had been sold interest rate swaps despite not understanding how they operated. Banks have denied any wrongdoing, saying they followed the rules. Swaps were a hedge against interest rates rising. When they collapsed in the wake of the financial crisis, many of the swaps became expensive to service. Those high costs forced many businesses to close. And here caused many state and local governments extreme financial pressure. Many have gone into bankruptcy. The claims of mis-selling have been compared to the controversy surrounding the sale of unnecessary personal protection insurance to millions of bank customers, also a scandal in Britain. All the banks deny they systematically missold interest rate hedging products. And from the Independent, members of Parliament demanded an emergency recall of an inquiry into the Iraq War this weekend after new revelations that Tony Blair blocked that government's most senior lawyer from explaining to his cabinet whether the war in Iraq was legal before it started. According to a newly published full version of the diaries of Alistair Campbell, one of Blair's top advisors, the Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, wanted to put the reality to cabinet ministers that there was a case against as well as for military action in March 2003. But according to his former spin doctor, Campbell, the then Prime Minister feared that the legal opinion was too nuanced and would allow the war's critics inside the cabinet to say the case had not been made. It's long been suspected Blair and his inner circle put pressure on the Attorney General to change his legal advice. This is the first evidence that the Prime Minister actively blocked the cabinet from hearing the full details of the case for war. But, ladies and gentlemen, there is top-notch British journalism at work today to get Tony Blair's response to that allegation from his former spin doctor. A hard-hitting question from the BBC's Andrew Marr to Tony Blair as Blair appeared on his program on the BBC today.
I understand why people still have this disagreement over Iraq, and I don't suppose we'll ever resolve it, but we should at least understand there's a balanced perspective on it.
Sure, but just to be absolutely clear, because it does go, I mean, the question of what cabinet government really is relevant to this. It's not true that you stopped there being a proper discussion of the legal case with the Attorney General putting his position in front of cabinet so that the people who disagreed could have their say.
No, it's absolutely not true. And by the way, they did have their point of view.
It's not true, is it? Hard-hitting question from the BBC, ladies and gentlemen. That's the kind of journalism we need more of in this country. More news from outside the bubble, though. In his strongest critique of drone strikes, Christoph Haines says some may constitute war crimes. He's the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions. He fears that the CIA-run programs in Pakistan, Yemen, and elsewhere would encourage other states to flout long-established international human rights law. In his strongest critique so far of drone strikes, he suggests some may constitute war crimes. Haines is a South African law professor. He said, are we to accept major changes to the international legal system, which has been in existence since World War II and survived nuclear threats? Some states find targeted killings immensely attractive, he said. Others may do so in the future. Killings may be lawful in an armed conflict, but many targeted killings take place far from areas where it's recognized as being an armed conflict. If there have been secondary drone strikes, he continued, on rescuers who are helping the injured after an initial drone attack. That's what we saw in the famous WikiLeaks video from Iraq. He continues now. Those further attacks are a war crime. There is great debate as to whether, as to how many civilians have been killed by U.S. drone strikes. Pakistan's U.N. ambassador in Geneva said the strikes had killed more than 1,000 civilians in Pakistan alone. But as we learned from the New York Times right at the beginning, right around the beginning of this, just before the beginning of this month, the United States has a way of explaining why we may be reporting so few civilian casualties with our drone strikes. According to the Times report, President Obama, who is in charge of personally proving the names of everybody who's targeted by drones, the so-called kill list, He embraced a method for counting civilian casualties that counts all military-age males in a potential strike zone as combatants, unless there's explicit intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. Counterterrorism officials insist, inside the administration, insist this approach is one of simple logic. People in an area of known terrorist activity are probably up to no good. There you go. Don't need a lawyer for that. It is a moment in time we're remembering on this broadcast because this New York Times report on the construction of kill lists, as I say, came out right at the end of May. The only real furor surrounding it has been who leaked? But story in the Times does report, and it details how President Obama goes about making the selection of the targets. He's presented with so-called baseball cards with, pictures and background on all the potential targets. In the wake of the death of the propagandist for al-Qaeda, an American named Awlaki, some administration officials, including the Attorney General, argued that the Justice Department should make public its legal memo justifying these targeted killings without the quaintness of due process. Obama had, in 2009, released Bush administration legal opinions on interrogation. But this time he chose to keep the Awlaki opinion secret. Once it's your pop stand, you look at things a little differently, said the CIA's former general counsel. Michael Hayden, former CIA director, now an advisor to Mitt Romney, said secrecy has its cost and Obama should open the strike strategy up to public scrutiny. This program rests on the personal legitimacy of the president, and that's not sustainable, said Hayden. I have lived the life of someone taking action on the basis of secret Office of Legal Counsel memos, and it ain't a good life. Democracies do not make war on the basis of legal memos locked in a DOJ, Department of Justice, safe. The nutty thing, the reason I'm focusing on this moment in time, is not only did that New York Times story appear just at the end of May, that very day or the day after, President Obama lavished the Presidential Medal of Freedom on several folks. Among them, Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan started out singing other people's songs, but as he says, there came a point where I had to write what I wanted to say because what I wanted to say, nobody else was writing. So born in Hibbing, Minnesota, a town, he says, where you couldn't be a rebel, it was too cold. Bob moved to New York at age 19. By the time he was 23, Bob's voice, with its weight, its unique gravelly power, was redefining not just what music sounded like, but the message it carried and how it made people feel. Today, everybody from Bruce Springsteen to U2 owes Bob a debt of gratitude. There is not a bigger giant in the history of American music. All these years later, he's still chasing that sound, still searching for a little bit of truth, and I have to say that I am a really big fan.
Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan stood silently during the ceremony. The author of Masters of War did not want to respond. Here's what he did not want to say.
Oh, you listers of Q, you think you're so smart. You list with your head, you kill with your heart. It's all remote control, no blood on your hands. But they all know your name in those far distant lands. You've got baseball cards from which you can choose. Folks who will win from those who will lose. The men who are young, which you'd be if you could, are okay to snuff. They're probably up to no good. Oh, your planes are all drones. No pilots at risk. Nobody to question. Nobody to frisk. It's all so precise. That's the way that it's played. And when you kill children, mistakes they were made. Now you're drawing the bullseyes in a war without end. Detainees are forever, so you don't apprehend. Oh, you doubled down on a wrong-headed war. We thought we voted for less, but you gave us more. Oh, you listers of Q, you think you're so smart. You list with your head, you kill with your heart. It's all remote control, no blood on your hands. But they all know our names in those far distant lands.
When it comes to writing prose, the words desert me, I suppose. I'm not cut out to be good with poetry. But when I hear the melody that sings to me from the start, opening up my heart, then I can play my part. Then I'm not talking moon and June or any old hackneyed phrases. Simply amazing couplets, a dime a bar. I never set my sights too high, content to bide my time. And if my days and nights go by without a single rhyme, I know what to do. Just tune in to you. Bend your soul to me, I trust what you said. Talking about the music, his wisdom was clean, good for my ear. No reason to deny that as the years go rolling by, the more determinedly I try to come up with what's a bit of melody. Gotta smooth it, laughing while you live, my friend. I'll be seeing at the rainbows and coruscating straight from the heart, working on a single in bar. I'm giving up my radio, it doesn't do me like ASN-53. And as for the box in the corner, I never tune it on because it only makes me blue. You see, and now I'm taking a new view. I'm turning the spotlight on you.
I may not be a Johnny Mercer when I spin a line. All I know is that for worse, better they're all mine. Now my song is through, all my dreams come true. Tuning into you. I'm tuned into you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Nobel Peace Prize winner about 20 years ago, Aung San Suu Kyi, the Burmese activist, democracy proponent, was in England this week, and nobody asked her, you know, based on the work of other Nobel Peace Prize recipients, when she was going to declare war on a small country. That just didn't happen. I don't know why. But now, ladies and gentlemen, news of News Corp. Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. Journalists at the shuttered tabloid newspaper, The News of the World, allegedly hacked into the emails of a key witness in a libel trial the newspaper fought against when the former aide to British Prime Minister Colson was editor of the paper. Fiona Maguire, a former escort girl who claimed she had an affair with a former Scottish parliamentarian, Tommy Sheridan, has been told by police her personal emails were hacked in 2005. So this is a case, apparently. There's evidence that the emails were passed around senior people of the News of the World in Scotland, said Stephen Heffer, her attorney. I can confirm the police have shown me evidence of her personal emails apparently having been intercepted and passed around. I don't know what they were trying to do. Well, they were trying to apparently hack emails and not only phone calls, but emails. And opposition folks have called for an inquiry after it emerged that London's mayor, Boris Johnson, Bojo, failed to declare a dinner with Rupert Murdoch prior to the Scotland Yard, that is to say London police, starting their investigation into phone hacking. Why would that have anything? The mayor and the police with the thing. The mayor's office has confirmed the dinner has been listed on the website for nearly a year. It wasn't declared on City Hall's Register of Hospitality or in Boris's formal reports. He did more than simply fail to mention it. This May, Johnson said, my meetings with News International have already been made public. Under my transparent administration, my advisor's declaration of interest, hospitality, and expenses are public. However, when BBC's London political editor asked for the meetings, he was told they were available in the mayor's diary, but they were not. It's by no means the first time the mayor of London has been found wanting in relation to the phone hacking scandal. Last year, he dismissed hacking allegations as, here's a nice British word for you, codswallop, before later admitting that he'd, quote, misunderstood the severity of the accusations. And the newspaper owned by Nice Corp, the Times of London, one of the newspapers, one of the surviving newspapers, wasn't shut down yet because they do nice things. They're nice people doing nice things. The Times has been running a series all this week about tax avoidance. And the front page of this edition right here, which I got free in the airline lounge, didn't have to pay for it, Rupert, focuses the front page story on doctors and dentists and some show business people who practice legal tax avoidance, trying to build a scandal out of that. Naming names. The only thing they leave out, shockingly, because they have a lot of room in the paper, even though it's tabloid size these days, the only fact that you'd think might be relevant that they left out was the fact that the American-based company, that has the third largest number of subsidiaries in tax havens around the world is Nice Corp. Ironic, isn't it? Now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
British comedian Jimmy Carr has apologized after it was revealed he was among the high earners who cut their tax rates to as low as 1% by channeling cash through a firm in the offshore island of Jersey. He used Twitter to issue a statement. I appreciate, as a comedian, people who expect me to make light of this situation, but I'm not going to. I met with a financial advisor and he said to me, do you want to pay less tax? It's totally legal. I say yes. I now realize I've made a terrible error of judgment. I'm no longer involved in it. Will in future conduct my financial affairs much more responsibly. Apologies to everyone. When launching a service to a new destination, labeling the citizens of that country as primitive probably isn't the best marketing tactic. Korean Air has learned this the hard way, following massive backlash from Kenyans after the airline described them as indigenous people full of primitive energy. The airline has now posted on its website regarding our recent promotional notice on Nairobi. We are checking on the issue accordingly. We sincerely apologize for this situation. Hundreds of knitters and crocheters sent angry messages to the U.S. Olympic Committee this week after a cease and desist order was served upon the Ravelry website over its use of the term Ravelympics. The USOC apologized twice for using, quote, insensitive terms and trying to have the needlework crafters website stop using the Olympic word so near to next month's London Games as possible trademark infringement. USOC had said, we believe using the name Ravelympics for a competition that involves an Afghan marathon, scarf hockey, and sweater triathlon tends to denigrate the true nature of the Olympic Games. They've now apologized for that. Dayline Chicago late-night talk show host Conan O'Brien, I know him, has apologized for a transgender joke he made during his Tuesday monologue. He took his show to Chicago, where he referred to Chicago as the city of the big shoulders, then joked that it was better than the name they almost went with, the unconvincing tranny. Come on, it was a joke. People.com online editor Janet Mock, M-O-C-K, see, you can't write this stuff, came out transgender last year. She chided O'Brien on Twitter. And actress Jamie Clayton, who played the role of Kyla on an HBO show, also came after O'Brien. He apologized in a statement given to GLAAD, not the bag people. My staff and I had no idea that term was offensive to the transgender community, he said. We apologize and you will not be hearing that term again. Unquote. An American... Oh, and picking on women. Southwest Airlines has been forced to apologize for telling a female passenger she was showing too much cleavage. She was boarding a Southwest Airlines flight from Las Vegas to New York when a staff member told her she was dressed inappropriately. She ignored the staff member and boarded anyway. The airline apologized for the misunderstanding, offered the passenger a full refund as a gesture of goodwill. The spokeswoman did stand by the need for passengers to dress appropriately. On Southwest. And the man in charge of Seattle's Parks Department, who himself is fighting cancer, phoned breast cancer survivor Jody Jakes on Thursday and apologized. She had been asking since February to be permitted to swim topless in Seattle public pools. She no longer has breasts since her double mastectomy. Conditional permission was granted on Wednesday. But the conversation about appropriate pool attire will continue. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And just one more item in the news of the godly department. Pope Benedict this week told Irish Catholics it is a mystery why priests and other church officials abused children entrusted in their care, undermining faith in the church. It's a mystery, ladies and gentlemen. It's a mystery. Maybe he needs some clues. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through an app from stitcher.com called Stitcher. And available as a free podcast from KCRW at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like getting the Pope some clues if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter, at The Harry Shearer. The email address for this program and the playlist of the music heard here on are at harryshearer.com. Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the Rubber Promise and the home of the homeless. So long from Santa Monica.